Welcome to Capital Connections. I'm Jackie Yamanaka with Capital Connections contributor Chuck Johnson. This week, we'll visit with two legislators, Senator Chas Vinson of Libby and Mary Cafaro of Helena. They're serving in their last legislative sessions because of term limits. They'll talk about how their background in activism led them to seek political office, the lessons they've learned at the Capitol, and what's next. Thank you so much to Senator Chas Vinson for inviting us to your office here at the Capitol for, final interview with you as a legislator up to this point. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being interested in me.
I wanted to ask you, because you've served in both the House and the Senate, lessons learned about this process.
Lessons learned. You know, if any of those that listen to my swan song, you know, I talked in depth about some of those things. I would say that one of the things that that's been most apparent to me in, you know, together would be the 12 years I've been here, is that some things have been changing and are changing faster in the process. Term limits have really come home for the legislature. The chickens have come home to roost, so to speak. And one of the things that I tried to talk to some of the younger members that are just getting started here is that while there's no way that I think we're ever going to be able to change term limits, the public likes term limits, and I think that to expect them to go away is something that would be foolish and a waste of time for our body to try to change that. But we still have to deal with it. And how best do we deal with that? And I believe that the best way we do that is to invest in each other as a legislature. And that means that we need to take the time to sit down and get to know each other, not only in our own caucus, but also across the aisle. Without term limits, that happened over time. It happened almost by accident, because you would serve so long with somebody, you would know where they were at or where you had common ground with. With term limits, you don't have time. You have to go looking for that common ground. And I try to pitch it to some of my new members in this way. Even if you're never going to have 80% agreement, you know, with different members of the opposite caucus, you're never going to find the 20% that you do agree on, unless you're going and sitting down and finding out why they disagree with you on that 80%. Number one, you're going to get better at making your argument, because you know what their argument is going to be against maybe something you're going to offer. But oftentimes when you're doing that, you find that common ground that you can then use later on a different policy matter in the future. Now, it also allows for the ability, and one of the things that I think more senior legislators have is the ability to not personalize policy. You have to separate the personality from the policy. And that's really difficult, because it's kind of an interesting oxymoron in a way, because in order to be an effective legislator, you have to make everything interpersonal and have those relationships. So it's really tough to, when you're doing that, when a person votes against your policy, they're not voting against you, they're voting against the policy. And getting to know one another is the only way to really make that be a process that isn't taken personal and doesn't allow those feelings to bleed into other things in policy.
When did you come to that realization?
You know, I would say that probably in 2009, my second session in the House, I was able to work with Senator Jill Konauer on a bill that was called, it was the Whippers Revolving Loan Account. We were in a collapse of the timber industry, and we had a lot of folks that were going under, mills and loggers, and what we were going to do with the bill is provide some low-interest capital to get them through the recession. And we also had inside of that some bonding to acquire some lands that Plum Creek at the time had sold to the Nature Conservancy, who wanted to sell to DNRC so that we could have more lands in our trust land division to provide more revenue for schools in the future. So it was a pretty complicated bill. There was a lot inside of it, but the bipartisanship, and you know, we fought with each other together on the bill in both of our caucuses. So it was two legislators, one Republican, one Democrat, working against so many odds, and we climbed such a tall hill, and we ended up getting it done. And in the end, the only reason we did is because it was bipartisan. So that was kind of a light bulb moment for me. If you can find those areas and you can work together, you can really overcome some really difficult things.
So basically, it was a Libby logger.
Yep.
You literally.
Yep.
I'm not talking about the high school. I'm talking about you literally. And then a chemist from Helena.
Yeah.
So let me ask you then, because you saw your dad, who was an activist, Bruce Vinson, trying to fight for the logging industry, really made a national name for himself. And then you took the step to take that a little further, to get in that policy arena known as the Montana Legislature. Your thoughts on that as you're seeing, you know, various demonstrations going around. Is it enough to just, you know, have roadblocks to hold rallies?
Well, one of the things that I think in the timber movement, what we learned was that, you know, there's certainly a need for showing and demonstrating that there is support for this or against that. I think that's really important. But unless you're going to do, and unless you're going to turn it into action, it's never going to achieve anything. And if you're not careful, what you can quickly become is the third ring of a third-ring circus, or a three-ring circus, and you'll find out that somebody else is collecting the gate receipts. And so you've got to be real careful with that type of activism, but you've got to channel it and turn it into something productive. And for me, watching, you know, watching the rallies and watching thousands of people come together to protest what was happening, the mill still closed. Our economy still crashed. And we came to the realization that, you know, we had to be in, we had to be engaged in the policy that was producing the outcome. And we were engaging, but we weren't engaging far enough. And so I did, I took that, the next step of getting involved in politics to help bring a state voice to the federal level. Most of our problems are federal on those issues, but this gave me an opportunity to have a microphone and be able to have conversations with people that do have influence at the federal level. So I feel that while I haven't achieved my goals as a state legislator on those ends by any means, I do believe I've helped move the ball. And I encourage anybody who wants to move the ball on those issues that they're rallying or that they're demonstrating on, they have to take the next step and they have to get involved. They have to take the time out of their life and commit to that issue in ways more than holding a sign or standing on a street corner.
So your tenure in the legislature is coming to an end because of term limits, if folks haven't figured that out from our conversation so far. As you look back on your legislative career, are there certain bills or issues that for you, you'll look to those and say, I'm proud of those?
Certainly. The one that I just mentioned with Senator Konauer, now Senator, we were both representatives at the time, that's one of them. And I think it was really kind of pivotal for me. And there's been several pieces of legislation that I will, you know, think fondly of and remember, either because they were it was really important and it was a big policy lift and, you know, I succeeded or maybe I failed. But really the one that will stand out the most to me, I think, as I look back, will be the CSKT Compact. And
yeah, for Confederated Salish and Kootenai Water.
Correct, okay. Yeah. And that was one of those things where I you know, found myself being a lead opponent against a compact in 2013. And then after making some substantive changes to it, ended up being the sponsor of it in 2015. And it was one of those learning and educational experiences that I had. And, you know, at the end of the day, I had to look myself in the mirror. And knowing what I knew and knowing that it was the right thing for Montana and knowing that I was going to have a lot of people in my own party and, you know, and across the state that did not have the opportunity that I did to educate themselves like I had, that it was my job to go educate them, or at least try to.
Right, and you stood up on the floor and in committee and on the floor and answered many, many questions for hours and hours and hours. Huge turnout.
It was. It was the longest, I believe, the hearing in the House was the longest hearing in legislative history. It was 12 hours long on a Saturday.
Because water's fighting.
Yes. We got whiskeys for drinking, water's for fighting.
Any regrets?
You know, I do have some regrets. Mostly, those regrets would be born from my learning experience. And, you know, I've always been one that came here with a great deal of passion. And mostly, a lot of that was based on the frustration and anger about what had happened at home. And so I came in to this body with a bit of a chip on my shoulder. And while I was getting some of the rough edges rolled around, you know, rolled off of me by other good legislators that invested in me, you know, I regret some of the things that I had said. I regret some things that I had done. That, you know, you can say things that hurt people. You can do things that hurt people. Maybe not for that purpose, not intentionally, but that was the you know, the outcome. And so really what I've learned about that is that, you know, every legislator in their growth and their process is going to have those moments where they do those things. They chose the low road, maybe not knowingly, but that's where they found themselves, is on the low road, not the high road. And when you find yourself there, what you've got to be able and willing to do is, number one, admit that you're there. I'm not where I should be. Number two, you need to be able to say that publicly and be willing to admit that publicly, that you were wrong and you had done something wrong. That takes some courage. And then you need to apologize. I think often people in this process underestimate the value of giving an apology to somebody and saying you're sorry, saying that you were wrong. And I also think that many people underestimate the value of accepting an apology in this place. And if more people were willing to do that, we would get along a lot better.
Is that what you were trying to say in your farewell speech to the Senate chamber? I mean, you thanked a lot of people from both sides of the aisle.
I did, and because there were so many people, and while we're looking at those things, while we're looking at how do we make this branch of government, as strong as it can be, against the headwind of term limits and having people that don't have the experience, and the turnover rate is unbelievable, particularly in the House. There were people that invested in me along the way that when you look back on it, maybe you're not thinking about it in that way at the time, but in hindsight, that's what they were doing. And so I wanted to show everybody that I understand what they did for me, I appreciate what they did for me, and to encourage them to continue doing it for others and for those senators that are coming up in the ranks to do that for others as well. Recognize when one of your seatmates is doing something that maybe they don't realize they're doing, and help them out with that, because no matter what happens from the inside of this building, it's Republicans and Democrats, you know, many times, and it can be apples and oranges on many different things. But from the outside looking in, from the public, we're the same basket of fruit. There's really no, you know, discerning a lot of those differences. It's the legislature in general. And so my message was, what we do individually affects us collectively. It affects our ability to do the public's will and to serve the public the best way that we should be serving them. And the way that I believe we accomplish that is by to continue to get to know each other, do it in a faster manner, and invest in each other regardless of party, particularly on those fundamentals that will produce success or prohibit success from being achieved.
What's next for you?
I don't know. You know, I have 4 young kids at home, and as I said in my closing remarks, when I first started here in the legislative session, in 2006 I was elected. I was a freewheeling single guy with hair, you know, and I'm now bald. I've manufactured 4 kids. I have a beautiful wife at home, and I'm missing a lot of their. I missed one of my 9-year-old's 10-year birthday last week, and I'm missing my 3-year-old's 4-year birthday tomorrow. So those things weigh heavy on me, and I think probably my best purpose for the near future is just to be home and be the best dad that I can be and be there for them as much as I can be.
But have you ruled out running for another office? You mentioned we started the conversation about the federal government and its impact. Have you?
You know, if the timing was right, and I think that's going to have a lot to do with home, you know, maybe a higher office if it was something that I thought that I could do and do well. That's the other thing. You can't do anything halfway. If you want to get into public service, you got to be able to give it 110%. And I would never put my foot forward unless I was confident that I can do that. At this point, I think I need to take some time and do some thinking and see where maybe my journey may go next. But in the immediate future, it's being home, being a dad,
and running
my business. Yes.
Well, with that, I want to thank you very much, Senator Chas Vincent of Libby, for sitting down and visiting.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're here today with Senator Mary Cafaro, a Democrat from Helena, who's concluding her 4th session in the Montana Senate, her final one under term limits. And Mary gave a speech the other day that was quite a talk, talking about her background and how she got involved in politics and we thought we'd like to get her to recap some of that in this interview. What led you to get involved in politics, Senator?
Well, first off, my parents were I come from a political family, and what I mean by that is we were the grunt workers in numerous campaigns. So my parents were always interested in politics, and they taught us at an early age to pound the pavement to get the candidate you wanted elected. So that's where I came from. But for a long time, I never saw myself as being able to hold office because of my life situation. And I think that that's common for people. But the message I want to send to people is, what inspired me to run for office and why everybody should think about this is I did a lot of grassroots organizing during the cuts during the March administration in the early 2000s. I did a lot of grassroots organizing trying to get low-income people to the Capitol to tell their story, to try to stop the cuts to essential services that they needed, cuts to Medicaid and that type of thing. So I had that in my back pocket. I was well known in the neighborhoods of Helena that are the neighborhoods of families who are low-income, senior citizens, people with disabilities. And so after 2003 session, with that experience, I decided, and I don't want to overemphasize my importance, but I really thought it was important for me to run for office and hopefully win, because I really wanted people at home to say, if she can do it, so can I.
What were the barriers you thought kept you back from running before?
Well, I don't have a college degree, so some people would say I'm not educated, though I am educated in the School of Hard Knocks. And that was, you know, because you attach a class to legislators. We attach a class. And in Montana, that's not how it works. And so that was one thing. I thought, well, I'm not educated enough. But in reality, what I knew was I have a direct experience with many of the issues that legislators make decisions about that they know nothing about. And not only do I have direct experience with poverty, with being uninsured, domestic violence, being a single parent, I also was fortunate enough to work for an organization called WEAL, Working for Equality and Economic Liberation, and it was my job to do the grassroots organizing, but also policy and budget analysis. So I thought that, well, I had some things against me. You know what? That's why we love Montana, because anyone can run for office. And I thought it was important to be pushing the button on these decisions that I knew something about, and also to send the signal that, you know, step up to the plate and run for office. Anybody can hold office, and anybody should hold office in Montana. We all bring great experiences with us. And this was one, you know, having the background I had was something that I thought would be valuable. I thought it might be helpful.
In watching you over the years, while not backing down from your strong beliefs, you have an ability that a lot of your party doesn't have to work across the aisle and get support from Republicans, maybe surprising support from Republicans some of the time. What do you owe that to?
Well, number one, I have, how do I put this? I'm an issue-based candidate. I mean, I'm an issue-based legislator. So I am committed to getting things done, and I'm not very political. So I learned when I worked for WEAL that if I could have a moment with a legislator to explain a situation to them, once they really understood, oftentimes they support these issues that seem controversial once they really understood. I find that Republicans care just as much as I do about people with disabilities. I find that Democrats care just as much as I do about people with disabilities. How do I get along so well with Republicans? I think the first thing is talking with them, understanding what's important to them. I just love people. To be honest with you, I find all people fascinating. And so it never enters into my mind that I can't get someone to support my stuff simply because of their party. And my stuff is people's stuff. You know, it's the issues. It's not about me. And so, and the other thing is, the longer I'm in the legislature, the broader my mind gets. And the more I find I vote for issues that are important to Republicans that I never thought would have been important to me. And that's helpful, too. They've educated me. I've educated them.
You've been in the House for 6 years and then the Senate for eight. What specific accomplishments would you like to highlight? What are you most proud of from what you've done in the legislature?
Well, I was fortunate enough to sit on the Subcommittee of Health and Human Services, the Subcommittee of Appropriations. And so in that role, though it isn't something you hear about, I was able to work really well with Democrats and Republicans on the committee and find pockets of money that maybe either weren't being used or were being used inefficiently. Find efficiencies within government, which I love to do, find efficiencies within government to free up money and then take that money and fund really important services.
Efficiencies.
What do I mean inefficiencies?
You know, you said efficiencies.
Yes.
Oh.
Cutting administrative costs and moving that money over to where it needs to go, which to me, Health and Human Services is about the people first. It's about the people first. And so I think that one thing that I'm really good at is finding money and redirecting it to where it needs to go, which is essential services for people with disabilities, for community services for senior citizens, for child care, for raises for the direct care workers, those types of things. So that is something that maybe isn't, you don't read about it in the papers, but I have a long list of stuff that we were able to accomplish to make to increase services for people who really need it by decreasing waste. I know that sounds like a line. It's not. It's the truth.
I know one of the big issues for you this session has been, and I don't know if it's resolved yet, to get a raise for direct care workers. Where is that? And direct care workers are the people that take care of our senior relatives, our disabled relatives, and the like.
Absolutely. So it's really important for people who are elderly to age in place now. We know that. Think times have changed. So community services for senior citizens, people with Alzheimer's, dementia, people who have developmental disabilities and physical disabilities, they're not shuttered away in institutions anymore. There's full integration. The expectation of children is I'm going to grow up and live in the community. That's the expectation of their families. And in order to do that, we need to make sure that we have workers who can care for folks. Workers who can make sure that that person who uses a wheelchair can get to work every day or get to college, that type of thing. So, yeah, my priority is services for people and to take care of the people that care for them. And the direct care worker wage was a piece of the tobacco tax that was really essential. That bill died, unfortunately, because it was a long-term solution. And what we have currently, there's three ways that direct care workers get a raise. One is the nursing home bed tax. I amended it to so some of that money would go for a raise for CNAs. Number two, found a pot of money and a raise for workers who work in the community with senior citizens and people with physical disabilities. So those two. And then the third one is for folks who work with people with developmental disabilities in the community may get a raise if we have enough money. In other words, if revenue comes in over the adopted revenue projection level. So
maybe you could tell us what direct care workers make now per hour and what you're hoping to bring it to.
Absolutely. And so for it's different for the different groups, but for the folks that work with people with developmental disabilities, it's the average wage is $9.80 an hour. That's just a hair over minimum wage. And oh my gosh, they do great work. They do great work. So that's a terrible wage, and most of them don't have benefits. Then the other thing is for CNAs, it's around $11 an hour. For people in the community working with, you know, seniors and people with physical disabilities, it's around $11 an hour. So really, the group that is hurting the most are the people who work with folks who have developmental disabilities. And these people, the workers, shouldn't have to sacrifice their dreams in order to make the dreams come true of other people.
And how much of a raise are you trying to get on these folks?
I think they all need $5 an hour. The tobacco tax was $4 an hour, and it was ongoing. Ongoing source of revenue, ongoing raise, and had a cost of living increase. You know, we really need to stabilize the workforce because without the workers, then everything collapses. And as a matter of fact, it's falling apart in the developmental disability world as we speak. So
now you've got 14 years of legislative experience in the legislature, and years before that as an advocate. Your term winds up next year. What do you intend to do after that?
Well, I hope that there's a House seat available in Helena to run in. And if there is, I'll run for the House. And if there isn't, then I will contribute in the ways that I'm used to contributing, and trying to get people organized and up here to advocate for the things they care about. I currently work for the ARC Montana. The ARC Montana is a grassroots organization that works on behalf of the human and civil rights of people with developmental disabilities. So, again, I have just the most awesome job. I get to help people for a living year-round. I get paid to analyze policy and budget and to get people engaged in the process. So I'll continue to do that. And I won't be able to lobby, though. I know I'm prohibited from lobbying. But hopefully I can run for office again. And if I run, I hope I can win and continue, because there's so much more to do.
And did you like serving in the Senate more than the House, or did it matter?
I did like serving in the Senate more than in the House, because I'm older and more laid back. And the Senate is just, that's how it is. It's, half the people, and so it's all. But you know what? I loved the House when I was there, too. So I think I would do fine over there, I hope.
So do you try to recruit other candidates with maybe unconventional backgrounds to run, to get the legislature more like what Montana really is like? Is that a goal of yours?
Yes, I think first off, I like campaigning myself. I love to campaign. I love going door to door. I love meeting with people. It takes me a long time because I listen to people. I have great conversations. I go into their home, drink coffee with them. That's why I am the legislator that I am, because I facilitate the process from someone in their easy chair to the floor of the Senate. And I work very hard to recruit and support candidates to run for office that come from diverse backgrounds. You know, Montana has a pretty diverse legislature in the House and the Senate, and it's more diverse than when I first started. So absolutely, I encourage people to run for office. And when I ran, I had all kinds of support for things you would never think of. People to help with transporting my kids back and forth to soccer. People delivered meals 4 days a week because I didn't have time to cook. People helped my children with their spelling words. I mean, all the things moms do. And so that's important to me, to pass that along to other people. And when I got sworn into the Senate in 2011, I was the only woman to raise my hand out of the 24 of us that were there. Then we were joined with Carmen Mowbray because she was appointed. So to go from being the only woman raising my hand to swear in 2011 to the Democratic caucus is two-thirds women and the rest men. So we have a diverse legislature. I'm honored to be a part of it, and I really hope that I can get the message across to people to not be intimidated by the process. That's why we live in a democracy.
Thank you very much, Mary, for sharing your views, and enjoyed the talk.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Capital Connections. Thank you for joining us. Our theme music is courtesy of the Alex Nauman Trio. Capital Connections is a production of YPR News.